This is fun! The FU Network! And now, here's your show.
Well, hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen.
And hey, look at this. It's us, really us.
People can see what we look like, which I think probably it would have been video killed the radio star earlier if people had been doing these kinds of chats, because you know the famous saying, people have a face for radio. And now they can see what we look like, and either it's what they expected, or it's better than they expected, or it's less than they expected.
Well, we're not going to put up a poll about that, because I think we'd be surprised by the results, or maybe not surprised by the results.
I think I'd be surprised by the results either way. So let's not do a poll. People can keep their opinions to themselves, or go on Twitter, which is what everybody seems to do with their opinions.
I've been talking about doing a video one for a while.
Yeah,
and I'll say that I was the holdup because I wasn't sure that I'm photogenic enough, but but now the world of Zoom has technology has overtaken us. It's now quite possible to do these kinds of things instead of just an audio podcast. You know, like 7-year-olds are doing this for play dates now, so it's about time a couple of guys like us got on board that train.
I didn't realize you were the holdup. I didn't think there was a holdup. We just hadn't done it, and here we are, and we've got a lot to talk about today because I pray for a time when there isn't that much news to comment on. I pray for boredom in the news, and I don't think we're going to get that anytime soon. But here we are, and the day we're recording this is the day that Prime Minister Trudeau announced that he's going to seek 10 paid sick leave days for all workers, not just federally mandated workers, but all workers. And there's a bit of a fly in the ointment on that one, isn't there, Stephen?
Well, a little bit. And I was on Twitter earlier today talking about it because labor and those sorts of things are the exclusive jurisdiction of the provincial government under the Canadian Constitution, under Sections 91, 92, and 93 of the Constitution Act, if anyone wants to look it up. And the federal government has the Canada Labor Code, but it is only it can only cover about 10% of the workforce in Canada, because those are employees of the federal government, of federally regulated industries like international transportation, banking, those sorts of things that are federally regulated. Outside of that, the federal government has no power to interfere with labor relations, because every province does it slightly differently. And also, labor relations are governed by collective bargaining, by unions who have got agreements, multi-year agreements in place. And so the federal government can't just sort of come in and say, hey, we're the federal government. We really feel like we should be doing something in this area that is not traditionally, constitutionally, a federal responsibility. Now, what the federal government has always done in the past, and people go, oh, there's Medicare and there, healthcare is a provincial thing as well. But the federal government has, the Canada Health Act and all the rest. Well, the federal government negotiates with the provinces to allow them to fund programs, to get into it. I mean, like unemployment insurance is a federal program, which is, a labor program, but it was brought in by a constitutional amendment in 1940. A couple things were going on then, the war. So it took an actual amendment to our constitution to create the unemployment, or now the employment insurance program. So those are the sorts of things where it's not just like the government can do it. Why isn't Trudeau doing anything about it? Same with long-term care. Maybe we'll talk about long-term care facilities later on. Long-term care is a provincial health matter, and it is not something the federal government can, go in and start running long-term care facilities. It is uniquely the preserve of the provincial governments. Now, provincial governments have always been happy to take federal money and maybe apply it to the project that it's earmarked for. Sometimes they just dump it into general revenue, and then they say, oh, sure, we spent it out this other pocket over here. But, and then take credit for it, because provincial governments love to take federal money and take credit for it. But there's a real constitutional problem about the federal government doing this. Now, I understand that the way that this is working is that the federal government, and they're still negotiating with the provinces, is that they say, look, provinces, we want to be able to offer 10 days of sick leave. We're prepared to pay for it, whether it's long-term, short-term. The other problem is once you get it going, if the federal government ever pulls the money, the provincial governments, which are on the delivery end of it, have to either cut the program, in which case they look bad, or they have to continue it, which means it costs them money. So, but Trudeau is negotiating, especially with BC Premier Horgan, to figure out how to fund and implement and deliver the 10-day program.
Well, so in a sense, is this either a premature announcement by the Prime Minister? Though he said he's seeking it. He didn't say he had it. But it's actually kind of, now that I'm speaking, it's kind of a savvy move, based on how the media works and how people respond to media, is to put it out there as the federal government and say, we want 10 sick days. And if any province goes against that, it hurts them, their reelection prospects, because they're the ones who voted against having 10 sick leave days. And they're not going to get support from the population that way.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, the federal government can say, look, we're trying, but you guys aren't playing ball. It works that way a lot in the healthcare industry as well, because the federal government puts money into provincial healthcare, and the whole idea is to guarantee a level of service that is uniform across Canada, because everyone should be entitled to the same level of quality care. It doesn't happen because we're a very disparate country. You know, access to medical services is very different if you're in Nunavut or in downtown Toronto or even in, you know, PEI. But, you know, they try to make it as even as possible so all Canadians access services, essential services, equally as much as possible. So, but the problem is, you know, some provincial governments, some things aren't covered. You go to one province, a healthcare package is covered. You know, certain surgeries, whether they're elective or essential. Well,
dental care, I think, is different province to province too.
Absolutely.
BC has a coverage of basic dental, I believe. Ontario does not. They don't care if our teeth rot out of our head, even though it's odd because, sort of to digress for a moment, the oddness of having dentistry excluded, because every other part of our body is basically covered. If we hurt a finger, if we hurt our toes, if we hurt our knees, it's all basically covered. But our teeth, which are in our mouths, which is part of our body, and they can cause, you can get very sick due to dental infections. Somebody I used to work with became septic due to very, very bad dental problems that started when he was a teenager. And in school, they were playing baseball, and somebody threw the bat and hit right in his teeth and screwed up his teeth. And he had troubles until he finally was so sick that the government was going to cover it because it was an immediate concern. He was septic. He was infected.
It can kill you.
It can.
And all you have to have is, you know, a bad tooth or a cracked filling or something, and you know how important your teeth are.
Well,
and
listen, having
uniform services across Canada, essential stuff, it's a great idea. 10 days of guaranteed sick leave across Canada is a great idea. It's really all about sort of how it rolls out and who pays for it. Ultimately, it always comes down to who pays for it.
Well, I mean, I don't know if they've already started doing this by the time we recorded this, but I'm expecting the Conservatives to start talking about all the people that are going to fake that they're sick. Because according to the Conservatives, Canadians are all a bunch of lazy fraudsters.
We're
not lazy at being fraudsters, but we're lazy, comma, fraudsters. And the thing is that this is not, the idea of 10 sick leave days is not just to benefit the person who's sick. It benefits everybody in the workplace, including the people, the proprietors of the business. Because people, listen, we've gone to work while we're sick. All of us have done it. Not so much because we're concerned about money all the time, but sometimes we do it because there's a project that has to get done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But we know that when we're working while we're sick, no matter how hard we try, our effectiveness is effectively reduced. Our ability to make decisions is compromised. And we work slower, so we get less done. And the longer we work while we're sick, the longer we're sick in most cases. And we're typhoid Marys in the workplace. We spread that sickness to everybody else. And so those who wind up contracting the illness are also slowed down. Their decision-making is compromised, all of these things. So it actually hurts the entire workplace. You're better off paying somebody who's sick to stay at home than having them come in and reduce the effectiveness of numerous other people in the workplace.
Yeah. So we've seen that in meatpacking plants and during COVID. I mean, somebody gets on the line or, you know, at Ford, anywhere where there's sort of assembly line facilities. One person gets in there and the contact is so close, thank you Henry Ford who invented this, that you can shut down an entire line because somebody gets sick. And we're seeing that with, you know, with COVID right now. But it's true in any time, you know, during flu season or whatever else. You know, anything that's contagious can wipe out an industry very quickly.
Now, if you were to predict, what do you think the chances are, the likelihood is that this 10 paid sick days will in fact become a reality for Canadians across the country?
Good question. A lot of it's timing. I mean, I don't think COVID is going anywhere fast, so I think there's time to roll it out. I think the odds are probably pretty good. I mean, the wild cards are always going to be Quebec and Alberta, sort of the moody teenage girls of Confederation. Quebec has gone its own way on so many federal programs. I mean, they've had stuff carved out from immigration to everything else where they run it themselves. They don't even have the Canada Pension Plan. They got their own pension plan. So how that fits into the way they see themselves as sort of a national government is one of the wild cards. Alberta loves free money. But you know, they'll complain about it, but they love free money. So Kenny could probably use a win right about now. I think they would be okay with it, but negotiating with, I mean, this is with anything that's the interprovincial, federal provincial relations or constitutional, is trying to get the agreement of 10 provinces and 3 territories for something, not just in, you know, at the high level, 10 days of paid sick leave. Everyone goes like, sure, sounds like a great idea. Then you start talking about, well, maybe the province should kick in a little bit of that. And all of a sudden, like, wait a second. Am I going to kick in the same amount as this guy does? 10 days for us? Is that too long? Is it too short? What administration is there going to be? Is it going to be federally administrated? Or do I have to put together a provincial administration now to be the hands-on delivery mechanism to check on the 10 days? The unions get involved and say, wait a second. My collective agreement says I get 14 days of sick pay a year. Does this new deal give the provinces or my employer the opportunity to say, no, I'm only legally mandated to give you 10. So now I'm going to cut back your collective agreement from 14 to 10.
I would think in that case that their collective agreement would hold. Just now you get 4 more days than you got before. Yeah. But I can't imagine a union letting them cut back 4 days of sick leave that they, you know, any kind of concession like that by business is a hard fought battle. And the unions fought hard to get that. It'll just be, yeah, now 10 days are covered. And the other 4, you know, it's up to the business to cover. And it's just a very odd circumstance. And I think that you're right about Quebec and Alberta, but I'm wondering about Ontario, because this puts Ford in kind of an odd space, because he rescinded the labor reforms of the previous Wynne government, which did include sick days. Yeah. And so now he's going to be asked to okay something he has already very publicly rescinded. And how will that play with his base? It's a good question. It seems that everybody who identifies themselves as conservative, or at least the loudest voices that identify themselves as conservative, are against, they just believe everybody is a liar and a faker and is dishonest, which says more about them than it does about the people they're talking about. But it's hard to get something like this through. I mean, Ford right now is talk about a wild card. Here's the guy that was putting stickers on gas pumps to try to hurt the federal government, and a guy who's constantly was blaming everything on Trudeau. And he turned around, I don't know, a third of the way into the pandemic after he told kids to go away on spring break and have fun. And they came back and the cases rose 14 days later. He's in a position now where he sometimes is supporting the federal government. And when he criticizes them, he turns around and says, oh, but they've been really great on working on COVID. It's an odd place for him. He's almost like Schrodinger's premier. Is he going to agree with the federal government? Is he going to fight the federal government? Well, we really don't know. He's trying to do both. He's trying to have his cheesecake and eat it too.
Yeah, and you know, even though he's a populist, I mean, his party's clearly in the debt of the corporate world. And the question is, what kind of a consultation and pushback is there going to be from corporate Canada saying 10 days of sick days? I can't operate if people are allowed to take 2 full weeks off and you know, on top of their holidays and all the rest of this stuff, it's actually going to affect my business because they're physically not going to be there. I'd rather them come in sick and cough all over everyone, like we were talking earlier, than not have them there at all. So I think it'll happen. And I think there's ways around all of these things. And I think, you know, at the base of it, it's a good initiative. I mean, the Canada Labor Code federally now says that employees can take up to is the magic word, 17 days. So, you know, there's a maximum that's higher than the 10 days already.
Yeah, but are those paid days or are those unpaid days?
I believe those are paid days.
I don't know. I was just working at a place where the contract specifically said that there are no paid sick days.
Yeah. Now, this doesn't apply to contractors and people on, you know, people like you and me who make their own.
I was a salaried employee.
Yep, and they're deducting...
And they were not allowing any sick days.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not a labor lawyer, so I'm not quite sure.
I wouldn't be surprised if they were screwing around anyways. They were pretty much a fly-by-night operation, which is why I'm not there anymore. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out because this is such a popular initiative. You're going to get far more people supporting it than are against it. And how can you really, as a province, say no to something that's motherhood like this? Yeah. It'll be interesting to see.
It makes a ton of sense. I mean, the devil's always in the details. And your original question is, do you think this is going to happen? I think, yeah, it's going to happen. But it's not as easy. You know, there's a lot of moving parts like anything like this. It's going to take a little while to sort of put it all together. It's not going to be like the CERB where it's like, okay, everyone gets $2,000 and here's the rules. It's, you know, that was, you know, it was amazing how fast it rolled it out, number one, but also it was pretty straightforward to program. This is a lot more sort of bits and pieces that you have to kind of keep take into consideration. So, okay. And, you know, and anyone, you know, the NDP pushed it. That's great. Good for them. I think, you know, Trudeau was pretty clear that he thought that he wanted to give credit more to Horgan, Premier of BC, because they were talking about that a couple of weeks ago. But and obviously it's a time to talk about it because so many people are having to take, you know, having to self-isolate and take sick time. You know, good idea. You know, a lot of good ideas are coming out of necessity these days.
Yeah, and listen, if the NDP want to count this as their victory, okay, go ahead, because sure. They have been pretty much irrelevant since the election. I mean, Jagmeet Singh may as well be the invisible man. He's not said anything particularly coherent or cogent on the issues that we've faced since you know, the last election. He's been, I don't know if he's been silent or it's just the media isn't all that interested in what he has to say. He certainly hasn't gained any traction in the media with anything that he's been saying, other than when he says stupid things, like when he says he's against something and then they ask him why, he doesn't know. But okay, you want to claim victory, fine, because you know what, the next election, people are still going to psychologically credit it to the Liberals, not to the NDP, because the Liberal government is putting it in.
And you know, and the party popularity of the NDP has been skipping along at 15-17% without any change through all of this kind of stuff. So it's clearly not resonating necessarily with the public. If they want to claim this as a moral victory, which they're really good at, then you know, good on them. But I'm not sure it's going to play. It's not going to make anyone except their own base very happy, because they really don't have much of an audience these days.
Well, you know, if the NDP wanted to raise their profile, they should learn from take a page out of a classic movie, which of course is Weekend at Bernie's, and they should just get Jack Layton back and just sit him in a chair, have people behind the chair making his voice happen. And because then you'll get attention, because the last time the NDP were on a rise and had momentum was under the late Jack Layton, who was, you know, I was fortunate enough to know him somewhat. And he's the only NDP leader I would consider voting for at any level of government, because I knew him and knew him to be a person of integrity, but also somebody who was reasonable and understood the needs of business and so on, didn't just dismiss them and wasn't, you know, constantly wearing Birkenstocks and spouting, you know, Stalinist or Leninist, you know, theology. He was somebody who was practical, and, you know, practical NDP leaders are in short supply federally. And Singh has just never impressed me as a parliamentarian or as a leader. Speaking of leaders that don't impress me, we can talk about the 10,000 people that showed up at Trinity Bellwoods Park in Toronto this past weekend. To my knowledge, they weren't all that concerned about social distancing. You see pictures of people packed almost cheek to jowl. And then the premier of our province, Doug Ford, says that, you know, these people were reckless and he was basically gobsmacked by the whole thing. And it's like, well, what did you think was going to happen when you've got a bunch of people who have been cooped up from the point, from the end of winter through to finally some nice weather? And we had a pretty long, cold winter. And people are leaning towards the idea that it's okay to go out. They want to believe it. And it's very difficult to go against what people want to believe. And when the premier himself is telling people to observe certain precautions, and then he himself very publicly does not heed those precautions, well, it leans into people saying, well, if he can do it, the danger must not really be as severe as they're claiming, because why would the premier put himself or his family in great, you know, in any greater danger? Well, he wouldn't. So it starts to make you wonder if those people screaming about this all being overblown and the social distancing being something that is actually hurting the economy more than it's helping people's health, whether they might not be right, because that's what happens when you are the leader of a province. You have to set an example, and the example he has set has been exceptionally poor, from going to his cottage, which he was there by himself. He didn't get near anybody else. That's somewhat forgivable, but the optics were terrible. And right now we're looking at optics, and those are very important. And then there was the Mother's Day fiasco, where he allowed his daughters to come up, and his excuse was, well, we hadn't seen them in so long. It's like, neither had anybody else. Has anybody else seen their parents who's been observing the proper precautions?
I saw my mother over Zoom on Mother's Day, and like so many people in Ontario did.
Yeah, like he could have done that. You know, you're supposed to set an example when you're the leader of a province, but I don't think he was ever really equipped to be the leader of the province. And this is showing that when you, as the leader, you set the tone and you set the pace. And when you are breaking rules that you're saying other people should you know, be following, then they're going to follow your example, not your words, because words don't speak as loudly as deeds. So this recent upswing that we've had in the number of cases in Ontario, it can be directly traced back to, based on incubation periods, Mother's Day weekend. Possibly people after Mother's Day going to see their mother after seeing that Doug Ford had done the same thing. His excuse was exceptionally poor. I mean, having his kids come up to see, you know, to see his wife, there's no excuse for that. You're the leader. You don't get to just do whatever you want when you are the premier of a province. Maybe somebody should have told him that before he ran. But I guess he's so used to thinking that he can call the shots and do what he does, and he's still going to have his base, you know, kissing his ass. I think that his base was probably really pissed off, because it's, you know, the blue-collar people and so on who really would like to see their parents, would like to see their mother, like to see their father, but aren't, because if Doug Ford says that it's real, that this is real and the danger is real, they're not going to go against that. But then he shows in his actions that maybe it's not so dangerous. It's not showing that maybe he's willing to take the risk. But as we've talked about before, the risk people are taking isn't something that's going to impact them so much as it's more likely to impact other people who come in anywhere contact of them. If they go into a store and touch something and somebody comes and touches the same thing afterwards. The fact is that if people were only going to harm themselves by going out and defying protocols, all right, see you later. But the fact is that they actually hurt other people, and people, they don't even know. There's no way to control it. And so it's not okay to go out and to defy protocols.
Yeah. And, you know, we had another politician have to fall on his sword just today, too. John Tory, Toronto's mayor, had to issue a statement because he went to Trinity Bellwoods Park to see what was going on and was photographed, you know, with his mask down under his chin, too close to people, you know, breaking all those sorts of things as well. I mean, he was there to observe, but, you know, he just got into the middle of it, and cameras are everywhere. People are going to see this. And, it's, you know, we had his apology today saying, you know, I broke all the rules. It really was dumb of me. I got no excuse. You know, it's just like, you know, it's difficult. This is difficult. I mean, we all understand how difficult it is. We all want to see our friends. We, you know, Zoom is better than nothing, but it's pretty annoying. And, you know, we want to go out. We want to go to a park. We want to hang out. We want to throw around a football or a basketball or walk dogs and see our parents or our kids. But, you know, it's, you know, the virus doesn't get tired of the rules. We're the ones who get tired of the rules.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know why more people aren't doing what I did. I bought one of those face shields from my drugstore, $14.99, and I don't have to wear something over my nose that cut.
Like a welder's thing, like a glass welder's mask.
Yeah, it's a clear plastic. It's mm-hmm. the thing you'll see store workers wearing.
Oh yeah.
And it means I don't have to wear something over my nose, which causes my glasses to fog up constantly. It provides greater protection because apparently the eyes are a very vulnerable spot for germs in the air landing
anything
on that semi-permeable membrane there. So having that mask, it gives me so much more freedom, and it doesn't feel nearly as intrusive as something covering you up like this. Yeah, and I mean, I have to hand it to a lot of people who've been very enterprising, have been creating businesses where they have been making masks. Now, these masks are not N95s. They're not the proper kind. The fabric is probably not, has the size of it is between the threads or whatever on a microscopic level is probably not big enough or small enough, I should say, to trap the germ particles. But there are people who are trying to make, it's like, hey, we have to wear these masks, make it part of fashion. And so you're not wearing like just a green mask or one of the white masks. You're wearing something with SpongeBob SquarePants on it or whatever the hell. Yeah. Pretty enterprising and I think pretty clever. And at least if people are only willing to wear these more stylish masks, it's better than them wearing absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it's meant to contain coughs more than anything else. It's not to keep stuff from getting on. Well, it
protects other people, not you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's your concern.
Everything is now turned into a little home factory where they're making these masks. And so, some of them are kind of stylish. My wife went and got one the other day, reversible. And like I say, I tried hers on, and I found it the fabric a little thick for breathing, especially if you get out in weather like we have today. It's 30 degrees, might get a little sweaty in there. But still, it's also a reminder to you that these are unusual times. And, if you've got it on you there, you're going to like, okay, this reminds me that things are different. I shouldn't be touching things. I shouldn't be touching my eyes. I shouldn't be, licking flagpoles. Or that guy, I don't know if you saw
toilet seats.
Well, there was the video of the guy at the Queen's Park rally this past weekend who decided, I think he had other issues than just COVID. But, he, in front of the camera, he decided he was going to go lick the statue of Sir John A. Macdonald in front of Queen's Park, just to show that he's not afraid of no virus.
The virus isn't impressed.
I know
that. Oh, no, we need to be afraid of this guy. The stupidity and the rationalizations that are being offered by people because they just want to believe that it's not true because either they're afraid that it is true, and afraid that there's something that they can't see with their eye, which is having such a tremendous impact on our lives, or they are just intent on showing that they are macho. And, remember that throughout history, the macho men, the masculine men, were always the ones who were, women and children first, which basically meant in those times, the people most vulnerable should go first, and I will endure the whatever pain or sacrifice is necessary so that they can get to safety. Somehow that's turned around to me first, women and children to hell with you. And that's supposed to be the new masculine, not giving a damn about anyone or any anything. I don't understand. I don't know exactly when that switch took place, but it's taken place because the definition of masculinity that these knuckle draggers have is clearly not the one that we were raised with. It's this new masculinity, which says, screw everybody except for me, which was never, John Wayne never did that. Because if he did, none of his movies would have happened. It would have started and he would have found out somebody was kidnapped and he would have gotten on his horse and rode to a saloon. That's the end of the movie. So the whole notion of what, the penis wagging that goes on with these people, it's a complete upending of what is supposed to be the core, the meme of what these masculine heroes were all about. And it's disturbing. What isn't disturbing, though, is some other places that have taken some steps to allow people into parks and allow them to remember social distancing. There's a park in San Francisco, or parks in San Francisco and in Brooklyn, New York, where they have the lines people who usually go out and put lines down for baseball diamonds and other things in parks. They're being employed to go out and put circles on the grass, and circles are 8 feet apart, and they're of a certain circumference that you can fit four or five people in comfortably, but it keeps people apart. And that's the kind of ingenuity that we need to start seeing, because this isn't going away anytime soon. And even when it gets further under control, or there's a vaccine or whatever, or a treatment plan, we're still going to still be leery. You know, those of us who are concerned about this are still going to be leery about putting ourselves at risk. So this is good. There's a restaurant that my wife showed me a video of last week where they've created bumper tables, which are giant inner tubes. Did you see that? Inner tubes on wheels. And you sit in the center, and there's a tray for your food, but you have to stay. They call them bumper tables, and you have to stay.
Bumper table.
What's that?
Whenever a kid is learning how to walk, you know.
Yeah, the walker.
They're full of Cheerios, except, you know, in this case, it's probably beers and wings, and you kind of scoot around. Yeah.
Yeah, and it looks like fun. You can have fun and still be social distancing. And these are the kind of brilliant ideas that we need. People being inventive about how to cope with what is the reality right now. I don't think this will be the reality forever, but for the foreseeable future, you know, they could come up with a cure tomorrow for all I know. But right now we're looking at something that is not willing to go away so fast. And yes, it still is primarily affecting people who have underlying conditions and who are seniors. But you know what? I think about the fact that underlying conditions definitely includes pneumonia. People who have pneumonia or had pneumonia recently, they're much more susceptible because this is an upper respiratory illness. And I think about people saying, well, some people are going to die. It's just the way it is. People die. And they're generally thinking that they're speaking about elderly people, which you should not be that cavalier about other people's mothers and fathers' lives. But I think about the time that I was hospitalized with pneumonia and became septic and couldn't breathe and almost died one night when I couldn't breathe. I think about that. And even though after I got better and left the hospital after a week and I went home, I was still very susceptible to something like COVID is. And you know what? I was 30 years old at that point. I celebrated my 30th birthday in the hospital. So these people are saying basically that there's other guys out there and other women out there like me who are young, you know, 20s, 30s, who have underlying conditions. To hell with you. And that's, you know, as somebody who was one of those people, I'm not comfortable with saying to hell with you, too bad for you, you shouldn't have had an underlying condition, you're going to die so that I can go to the mall.
Yeah, and you know, and there's all kinds of people, like you say, it's not just old people. You know, there's all kinds of people with immune system diseases, you know, whether it's Crohn's or colitis or lupus, or, you know, there's all kinds of compromised immune diseases that are genetic that are out there, and that is all ages. And you don't know if one of my neighbors that has colitis, Crohn's disease, and you just don't know, you know, who you're standing next to and who is vulnerable. So, you know, it's nice to be able to say, okay, you know, put all the old folks on an iceberg and the rest of us will all be fine. The disease doesn't work that way.
No,
and sure,
no.
People are going to sail through it just fine. You know, there's all those apocryphal, well, not so, so those rare stories that the press loves to say, you know, the 101-year-old who came through coronavirus and she's just fine, is supposed to make us feel better. Say, well, sure, that happens, but I wouldn't want to bet on it. Chances are, you know, a lot of people are going to get sick if we just take off all of the social restrictions. And I'm pleased, you know, walking on, you know, Canadians have adjusted, I think, Trinity Bellwoods Park notwithstanding, we've adjusted pretty well. I just know just walking down the street, you know, on a beautiful day, the Danforth will be full of people, but people will automatically give each other the edges of the sidewalk as much as you possibly can to give people space, or right, duck in between parked cars to let you pass. You know, people are pretty aware of that, but there will always be this group of people who are going to live forever, and they, you know, they just don't care about other people.
Listen, my best friend came by as a surprise on the weekend to give us something, and he brought his two kids, and we were in our house with the door open. They were out on the front, you know, lawn area. We kept our social distance, but we talked, and then, you know, they left after a few minutes. But you know, I wanted to give they're basically my niece and nephew, wanted to give them a hug, but couldn't do it. They understood, we understood. It's, you know, we adapted so that he was still able to come and bring us the thing he was bringing us, but we didn't break social protocols. And, you know, one of my best friends, lifelong friends, had a kidney transplant at 16, and a second one when he was in his 30s, and he's the same age as me, and he'll probably need another one sometime in the near future. So he's constantly on anti-rejection drugs and so on. So he's vulnerable.
Immunosuppressant drugs generally, because you don't want your body attacking the new organ. So
exactly. Saying, hey, you don't belong here. But yeah. So I feel, you know, I worry for him. He's observing everything. He's very cautious. You have to learn to be cautious when you have that situation, but you know, I worry for him. And so when I hear these sons of bitches saying, you know, some people are going to die, it's like, okay, how about you volunteer? You know, it just makes me angry. And they're also saying that it doesn't matter if my parents pass away because it's not their parents. And maybe they don't even give a damn about their parents. Maybe they don't have parents anymore. I don't know. All I know is that cavalier, callous attitude. I just want to grab these people and wring their frickin' necks, because they're talking, they're dismissing the right to life of people I know and people I'm related to. And that just pisses me off. And I think that it's okay for people to be angry about this, because it's not funny. You know, it's not funny. The thing they're doing, you're not impressing anybody with your crazy conspiracy theories. I'm sorry you can't handle that there is something going on that is beyond the purview of man or humans to control at this moment. I'm sorry that makes you, you know, want to suck your thumb, but go suck your thumb and do it at home away from other people. You know, I've got a family member who was in the U.S., came back, had to self-quarantine for 14 days, and they have a basement apartment, had to live apart from his wife and two kids who are above for 14 days. And that's a hardship. You come home, you want to see your kids and your wife.
Yeah.
He had to go in a separate exit. Yeah, I had to go in a separate entrance and live downstairs the entire time. So people are doing it. Like, you know what? Here's the thing. While it's something of a hardship to isolate in place, or whatever they call it, the Americans are shelter in place that's their hurricane warning. Thing. But self-isolating, it's tough. But you know what? You have a roof over your head, you got food, you've got heat or air conditioning, or you can open the window or have a fan going like I have back there. Like, honest to God, previous generations, sacrifice was going to war, you know, World War II, or Korea, you know, going out, enduring horrible privations for the common good. And we're complaining because we have to stay home? Like, just it boggles the mind what people now consider to be sacrifices that are just untenable. You're staying home, and the government is stepping up and helping to cover some of your costs while doing that. Tough for you, really. You're a talk about spoiled generations. That I don't want to stay at home. Are you eating? Yeah. Do you have a roof over your head? Yeah. Okay. Then just shut up, okay? Watch TV. Read a book, for crying out loud. Just, that's the kind of sacrifice we're asking you to make? That's not much of a sacrifice.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, people talk about the Second World War and the Blitz in London, and people had to, leave immediately because a Luftwaffe was coming to blow up your house, go down into the tunnels, go into the subways, and be there for a couple of days sometimes. And come up not knowing if your house is going to be there, and all your services disrupted. The fact that there's nothing good on Netflix is hardly, you know, the end of the world. It's like, it just, you know, stop being such an immature teenager about this, and we're going to get through it. And it'll take months. You know, one of our earlier Stephen Steen podcasts, when this was early and nobody knew what was going on, we thought, or at least I thought, and I was saying, you know, it'll be a few weeks, maybe a month and a half before this blows over, sort of like flu season. Well, it clearly isn't, as things have evolved. It's a much more pernicious virus. It's got into the system. People are behaving some good, some bad. We see what's happening in the United States, where they're starting to flatten the curve, and then they open up all the beaches and the parks and the amusements and the pools, and everyone just goes nuts immediately. It's like, well, you've just bought yourself another 2 months, people, because that's what happens. Someone said it's a popular meme on Twitter. It's like, well, my parachute is worked halfway down. I'm kind of slowing down now, so I guess I don't need my parachute anywhere. I'm going to take it off for the last half of the ride. It's like, you need it till you get to the ground. And then, when you're on the ground, wait a couple of minutes just to make sure you're okay. But yeah. This is no time to be taken off the parachute.
Well, you know, the people that are saying, look at the death rate. It's not very, very high. It's, it's not unacceptably high, as they would put it. And I don't know exactly what acceptably high is. But the fact is that the number of individuals who've passed away is not like it is in the United States. We're not even per capita like it is in the United States. Yeah. And that's they use that as a reason to justify their idea that this is not really that serious an issue, as opposed to looking at it and saying, hey, you know, doorknob. The reason that the death rate has stayed relatively low is because people have been self-isolating. Yeah, it's like your logic is inverted. The reason that it's low is because people have been obeying the precautions. Your idea that it's low just on its own. We don't know what the death rate would be if people weren't self-isolating, because we're self-isolating. So you're talking about nonsense about, you know, the road not taken, and then it's easy to connect the dots between the times that people have gone out en masse and, intermingled with each other without taking care of precautions, and the rise in cases. I mean, it's very much a cause and effect. You can see it. So anybody who's saying that this is just nonsense and, there's other countries like Japan where they weren't doing social isolation and, they're fine. For a long time, they touted Sweden as being a case where they weren't doing, heavy lockdowns type
procedures. They're self-isolating and they're doing great.
Yeah, and now they're not. Yeah. Yeah, now we're seeing, they're reaping what they sowed with their lax attitude towards this.
Especially when you have Finland and Norway on either side of it. And they've been like Canada. They've been doing, social distancing and self-isolating and lockdowns. And their rate is so much lower than the neighbor right in the middle, Sweden. There's proof that this works. I mean, will it save a lot of lives in the long run? It's hard to tell. Are we just flattening the curve, which is just taking the same number of deaths and spreading it over a longer period of time so it's manageable? You've got to think that we are saving lives, because you just look at a long-term care facility. If you are able to keep it out of a long-term care facility, those people wouldn't die. It's as simple as that. And so that's on the good column. So it's not just a question of, well, people are going to die anyway, so we might as well just get it over with and get on with our lives and go back to work and get that economy roaring again. And so that's not the way this works.
No, and I think that, I think that generally once this has, for whatever reason, whether it's a treatment program that's successful or a successful vaccine, when we go back to normal life again, when things are open and so on, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of change in people's behavior. I think that people will be leery of public spaces where people are compressed for a while, but we will eventually, it's just the nature of humans. We want to put bad thoughts behind us. Mm-hmm. So we're going to try real hard to put that behind us by putting good things in front of us. Yeah. So I don't think this is going to change a lot of attitudes en masse, but there are some things that I think will be definitely changed as a result of this. And one of those things, I think, at least I hope, is looking at the plight of low-income workers, poorly paid workers. Mm-hmm. Because we've got now, I mean, there's this attention being given to people who work grocery stores and things like that, low-paid jobs, people who, and the fact that there's such low pay for people at long-term care facilities that they have to work at three of them in order to make ends meet. And these are people that, these are facilities that are being entrusted with caring for our elderly. And we have an obligation to them to make certain that where they're going is safe. And I would think that, talk about precious cargo, your parents. And people put their parents in those places or help them in those places, or their parents have chosen to be in those places because we think that it's a safe place for them. We think it's the best place for them, for their quality of life. We have an obligation to make sure that that's true. And these number of businesses that are now saying that because of CERB, because of people receiving $2,000 a month, that their workers aren't coming back to work, is opening up the door to people realizing that, wait, there's that many people who are working for less than $2,000 a month. Because for a lot of people, $2,000 a month is not a raise. It's not a salary increase. In fact, you're making less than you would be, but you're concerned about your safety. But it's really made it clear that there are so many people in this economy who are working at rates that are not sustainable for them to have to exist, to be able to pay their bills and live a decent life. Minimum wage used to be, that was the minimum amount people needed to live a decent life. Mm-hmm. Now it's not that anymore. You work 40 hours a week at minimum wage, you're not able to afford a decent way of life. You're not able to raise kids properly. You're not able to do these things. So the whole purpose of minimum wage has gone out the window. And it's the minimum people have to pay you. It's not the minimum needed for living a decent life. So the meaning of minimum wage has flipped as well. But the number of businesses who are saying that they need, you know, they want to open up, but their staff won't come. Well, that tells me that you're running a business. Your business survives basically by exploiting people.
For
low. So if you can't afford to pay people a living wage to work in your business, if your business is going to shut down, it's not tenable, it's not viable while paying your staff a living wage, then your business isn't viable. Then your business is surviving on exploitation of your staff. And that's your business if your business can't survive paying people properly, then your business is actually living on borrowed time. And you're borrowing that time from your staff. You're draining their life energy to keep your business alive. And that should not be allowed. And I think this is being put into sharp focus here. I think that the fact that the idiots in the opposition party, Her Majesty's loyal opposition, led by that dunce Andrew Scheer, continuing to pound the desk on fraud, Canadians are liars, Canadians aren't going back to work. First of all, Canadians like working. And people generally go to work for a number of reasons. They go to work not just for the pay, though that is a key, but you also go for the personal satisfaction of knowing that you're doing a job and doing it well, the camaraderie and interaction with other human beings. There's so many reasons that you can't put on a ledger sheet that people go to work and see benefits in going to work. You can't simply say that because people are getting $2,000 a month, they prefer to sit around in a hammock. That's just the fundamental view of human beings that people who say that have is just so skewed. And it makes me afraid that there are people who say that because clearly those people are expressing what they would do if they had the opportunity, or expressing that they very clearly are not trustworthy. Because, you know, as we talked about in a previous show, people who are trustworthy assume everyone else is probably trustworthy. They lean towards that direction. People who are untrustworthy... What's that? Yeah, people who are untrustworthy generally assume that everybody else is as untrustworthy as they are because they don't see themselves as bad. They see themselves as a normal individual. So if I'm a normal individual and I'm not trustworthy and I know that people can't trust me, I'm going to assume that everybody else is at least at that level, if not worse. And so it's telling me that people like Andrew Scheer, and it's been borne out by fact, are shady and are not to be trusted. I mean, his own party booted him out of the leadership, even though he's still there for some reason, because he was dipping into the party's funds to pay for his kids' schooling, as if he wasn't being paid enough money on his own to pay for schooling. And if he wasn't, then I guess you can't afford the schooling. Like, this whole idea of the Conservatives have of this vision of humanity, vision of Canadians, is so far off the mark. It explains why they've lost two elections in a row and are working really, really hard and tirelessly at losing a third.
Well, and I think what the Conservatives are really afraid of is this time of crisis and this dislocation of society that we're looking at right now is really going to be, it has really shown the limitations of greed-based capitalism. That, you know, like you said, if your business model is exploitation of workers is the only way I can get by, forget the fact that it's supposed to be a free market, where the market sets the value of things with everything except for value of your labor. They're afraid that Canadians, particularly, I don't think Americans are in danger of this particularly right now, but Canadians are going like, yeah, maybe there should be a higher minimum wage. Maybe there should be guaranteed sick time. You know, whoever is whether provincial or federal, somebody ought to be able to do this. You know, that maybe long-term care facilities based on the profit model are a bad idea, the way that in the United States, hospitals based on the profit model are a bad idea. Maybe that should be more closely regulated by the government, whether it's provincial or federal. And maybe they shouldn't be allowed to be for profit. Maybe they should all be some either not-for-profit or government-run or hybrid model. It really is the conservatives' worst nightmare, because the flaws of the politics of greed are being shown in really sharp contrast. It's making a lot of Canadians go, maybe there's a better way of looking after each other like this, because we really do depend on people. We do value the people who have the jobs stocking the shelves, or, you know, running the cashiers, or the short order cooks in the back of the thing. That, you know, we depend on these people a lot more than we realize when they're invisible. When we don't see them, the system's working fine for us because we're at the front end of it. Canadians are starting to go, yeah, we really should be caring about these people a little bit more, and maybe setting up a system that's a little bit fairer. We take a little bit of the rough edges off it. So yeah, the stock market's doing great. The Dow Jones is doing great, as is all over social media. The billionaires are becoming trillionaires. Some people are doing really, really well. We don't worry about them. We worry about the people who aren't doing that well. The Americans are going to be really slow coming around to that idea, because it goes against all kinds of things they believe in. But Canadians have had this system for a while, with our healthcare and our pension plans, and you know, the way we look at, you know, unemployment insurance. These are all things that lead Canadians to think, well, maybe it's time to extend some of these programs to other aspects of our lives to make some people's lives a little easier. You know, it means taxes, or it means the reallocation of resources. It's the sort of thing I think that can be one of the lasting changes that COVID-19 brings to Canada. It really gives us an idea of, you know, Canada can be a better place. And I think that is something conservatives are scared to death of.
Agreed. And, you know, you talk about greed-based capitalism. There are people online who say that all capitalism is greed-based. And I don't believe that's true. We have a different kind of capitalism in this country. It's not perfect, but it's different than the United States in that we have social programs. My wife, Leanna, has labeled them as supportive capitalism social programs, because they allow capitalism to exist, the competition to exist, but at the same time sands the rough edges off so that we can have a more humane capitalism. And quite frankly, in the US, they've moved to corporatism, not capitalism. Capitalism is based on competition. And the US has built monoliths. You know, businesses are monoliths like Walmart and Amazon and so on, who just destroy any local competition. And so that's not, once you start destroying competition and you have giant companies providing huge number of products and services to people, that's not capitalism anymore. Capitalism depends upon competition between, you know, different businesses, and that allows labor to have options, you know, to go to the people that treat their staff better or pay better. It allows for there to be you know, that natural tension between competitors, and it makes you innovate. It makes you work harder. But these people who have, and I have a hard time blaming somebody for starting a successful business. You know, like the late Sam Walton started Walmart. I have trouble blaming somebody for having a successful business or having an idea that clearly provides services or provides something to people that they feel they need. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there really should be, you know, the idea of a good corporate citizen, which used to exist, should be something we start looking at again, because Amazon can clearly afford to pay its people better and treat its staff better, and they don't. And in America, that's seen as, well, that's capitalism. No, it's not. Capitalism is not based on exploitation of workers, as some people claim. It's based on competition. And when you have a properly functioning capitalist economy, you have competition between businesses, you don't have monoliths, and you have staff, you know, mobility for labor to go to places that treat their staff better. They provide incentives to go work there. And when you go to a place that you feel cares about you, or at least doesn't treat you like a piece of crap, you're more likely to want to put, you know, your better work into it as well. It's counterintuitive, the system that has developed in the United States and, you know, is starting to take some root here. It's not capitalism. People who think this is an indictment of capitalism, it isn't. It's an indictment of the way capitalism has been interpreted and perverted. And you know, if you want to look at who has the least amount of rights, I think the workers in China probably have far less rights than the workers here in Canada or even in the United States. If you look at the way that they're forced to live in on bunks, among, you know, amongst each other, packed cheek to jowl, and the low wages that they receive so that China can sell products cheaply, that's communism. And you know what? there are more people, more workers there in unfair conditions, what we would consider unfair conditions or unsafe conditions, than there are here in North America. That doesn't mean, though, that by comparison, we should say, well, we're doing fine, because we're not. We can do better. And I think, as you said, this pandemic and calling into sharp focus the fact that we rely on these workers who mostly are considered, they're either, if you're lucky, people consider them invisible, but mostly they actually look down upon them. Because, oh, this is what you're doing. No, these people are the links in the chain that allow us to live the lives we live. And I fear that once we go back to things being normal, people are going to associate putting greater value on these service workers as part of the mindset they want to forget, which is they're going to associate it with COVID, and they're going to stop thinking about them, and we're going to go back to treating them as either invisible or as people that we deride. I hope not, but I'm a little bit of a student of human nature, and I'm concerned that's what's going to happen. I hope not. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, and the other thing too is I think COVID has given us an idea, you know, in terms of global capitalism. You know, people have said, well, you know, why did the federal government, you know, we don't make any PPE here. We don't make gowns and masks, and it's all being made in China. And so over here, we're really beholden to China for all of this kind of manufacturing, whether it's ventilators or, you know, whatever it is. And people are, you know, who buy off Amazon, buy, you know, wherever it is that, you know, online, you know, you go to Alibaba. And, you know, you can find, you know, all kinds of stuff because it's basically, you know, China's Amazon, the stuff that doesn't get routed through Amazon itself. And you realize how little is actually made here and how dependent we are on other countries. You'd be like, well, what's the government doing about this? It's like, it wasn't the government. It was businesses looking for cheaper labor because they don't want to pay minimum wage here. They don't want to pay 15, 14 bucks here. I mean, Amazon, I saw an ad just online earlier today that they're looking for warehouse people, you know, people to pack and ship and all the rest, $16.75 an hour. No experience necessary. You can be working in 7 days. You know, that tells me they've got to pay more if they're that desperate for workers. But they've outsourced, the corporations have outsourced all this work to China. China got too expensive. They're outsourcing it now to Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, other places where, you know, China now insists on, you know, $5 an hour. You can still get a buck an hour or a buck a day in Vietnam. So they outsourced all of this stuff. They put the production over there, or they found someone to put all the production over there, and all they do is they ship it over here. And all of a sudden, we find we can't get the stuff that we need. China, the biggest thing the Americans were saying, well, China knew about COVID, so they started hoarding all the PPE, all the masks and all that kind of stuff. They wouldn't ship it to the United States, so that's why they didn't tell the Americans, tell the WHO that this pandemic was coming, so they could hoard all these resources. Like, they're made in China anyway. If the United States knew that a pandemic was coming to the United States, they wouldn't be shipping vital supplies overseas either. Not that I believe it, you know, it's just a crazy conspiracy theory, but it really highlights the fact that all of this stuff we're so reliant on comes from overseas to markets that we cannot control, and often with governments that close the doors. You know, they're not democracies. They don't worry about this sort of stuff. They don't worry about public opinion or a free press or anything else. They just say, nope, you're not doing it anymore. So I think we've also realized just how vulnerable we are, not just to capitalism generally, but to globalist capitalism, where so much of Canada is being manufactured overseas. And that's because as consumers, we don't want to pay higher prices. I don't want to go and pay $6 or $12 for a Canadian made mask that I can get from China for a buck. And you know, they're already making a profit on that. As a consumer, I'm demanding lower prices. I'm prepared to put up with maybe, you know, bad human rights records, shady production, questionable supply chains, all that kind of stuff, because I want a cheap price. I want to get the cheapest desk chair, piece of furniture, piece of crap to hang on my wall as possible. I'm not prepared to pay what it costs to have that made in Canada and pay a decent wage. So I'm not sure what the solution is, but the thing about the COVID pandemic is it's really made people think about a lot of these issues. And as soon as you start thinking about them, you start thinking about solutions, whether it is regulations, higher wages, better safety net, the right kind of stimulus to Canadian manufacturing, you know, rethinking who some of our trading partners are. There's all kinds of things. But I think there are going to be some really lasting changes to it if we're smart, because clearly we just can't keep going on like this, because next time there's a crisis, whether it's war, pandemic, or something else, we're going to be in exactly the same situation. And hopefully we will have learned a lesson. We didn't necessarily remember any of the lessons that we learned from polio or the Spanish flu or H1N1.
Or SARS.
SARS or swine flu or MERS or any of those things. Those things have all been lost to our consciousness. It's like this is the first time this has ever happened in human history. It's like, no, this happens pretty regularly. We've just forgotten, and we're just, you know, we're just being big babies about it.
Yeah, and I wonder if, I certainly hope that this pandemic and the, you know, the things you mentioned about us not manufacturing things, about us being comfortable with buying things because they're cheap, despite the fact that somebody is probably suffering to provide that to us. You know, like, we don't think about, when we buy stuff that's made in China, we don't think about their human rights record. Why? Because we're really good at blocking things out we don't want to think about. And the fact is, if we thought about it, we would, you know, well, there is the problem of, well, if we don't buy it, then those people are going to be unemployed, and that doesn't help them either. It's a quandary, but we don't think about it. We don't demand better from China. We could say, look, we're not going to buy your stuff anymore. The government could say, we're not buying anything from you guys anymore until you improve your human rights record. That's the only thing that would really grab them by the testicles and get them to try to change anything. But I wonder if maybe we're going to start looking again at the concept of enough, which is that there was a time when we understood that there was enough. Like, you're making a profit for your shareholders, it's enough. Rather than trying to wring every last penny out of things to the point where you're creating inhumane working conditions and creating inhumane management attitudes, you know, the idea that you know, lives are lived quarter to quarter, it's foreign to me because I didn't grow up with it. I grew up with the notion of there is such a concept such as enough. You don't always have to acquire more and more and more and make more and more and more money. There's a point at which you're comfortable, and that should be okay. And that's gone away. This whole notion of enough has just gone away. Nothing's ever enough. And if you accept enough, then you're just some kind of loser. You don't want the best for your family. And that's just a very, very hard, we've seen. It leads to a society that is more and more predatory. And we don't want that. And yet we're participating in it. I like the concept of enough. You know, shareholders, we're making this much money. It's enough. I remember when I was at Chum, may that company rest in peace, and they did their first ever layoffs. They had never done layoffs before. Why'd they do layoffs? Because they made a profit, but not enough of a profit for the shareholders. So people paid for that in their jobs, and other people paid for it who were left behind because they had to pick up the slack and do more work than they were doing before because people aren't there anymore. And I really think that we need to start looking at enough, because you know what? There's somebody I know who earns a lot of money, but this person doesn't see their family, doesn't see their wife, doesn't see their kids, is constantly on the go, 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 is always stressed out. And I said to my wife, I said, you know what? Sometimes money is too expensive. And working for that, you know, yeah, you're earning that much money, but what are you losing on the other side? We're so wedded to the balance sheet of life. And it's all, you know, figures in the profit or loss category. And you can't really quantify these ephemeral things, such as quality of life, such as being satisfied with what you have. You always want to improve yourself a little bit more. That's what we're based upon. That's human nature. But this business about rushing to enrich yourself at the cost of everybody else, you know, the screw everyone, all that matters is what I get. That's a sickness that comes from the United States, unfortunately. Not everybody, of course, in America subscribes to that, but there are too many that do, enough to make it significant. And it's come in through Canadian conservatism here, and even just general people who are not politically involved at all. There's this notion, you got to have more, got to have more, got to have more. And advertising tells us that we're not happy unless we have more, 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 more. I understand their motivation. They're trying to sell us shit. But we don't need those things.
No, and I've seen, you know, it's interesting watching how advertising for different companies, especially car companies, have responded to COVID-19. And there's one ad. I mean, they all try to be, you know, we're good corporate citizens. We care about you. Stay safe. Don't worry. We'll give you time to pay or whatever else. There's one. It was a luxury car commercial, and you know, the message was, you know, times are difficult. But if you really want a new car right now, we can arrange to do that so no one touches you. It's like, well, who's thinking about needing a new car right now? I mean, sure, gas is cheap, but no one's going anywhere. Getting a new car is not the first thing on anyone's mind right now. And it's part of this consumerism culture. And I think people are, and I think a lot of manufacturers of luxury goods are a little worried, but people are certainly going to want to treat themselves when all this is done. But I think a lot of Canadians are starting to realize, you know, I can get along with a lot less. All the stuff that I thought I needed, I don't really need. I'm enjoying, my life right now. Sure, money is tight. And as you said, CERB is helping people cover basic necessities. But, no one's getting rich off of it. But I think people are making do with less. They're baking their own bread. They're making meals. And instead of going out to restaurants and doing takeout all the time, people are starting to realize that. I'm just personally realizing, I'm looking at my Visa bill every month going like, wow, I'm not spending a lot of money anymore. And I don't, sure, there's stuff I miss, but I don't feel like I'm being deprived particularly right now. That's a lot of discretionary spending that maybe I'm, once I have the big party at the end of lockdown, once that's out of my system, my lifestyle may change. And I think a lot of Canadians are looking at that way too. I mean, there's always the people who are going to be, I'm so bored inside, I'm going to spend my whole day on Amazon and order a whole pile of crap that I don't need and just try on 15 pairs of shoes and then send them all back. I'm sure there's people like that too, but I think more people are starting to realize that we can get along with a lot less.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that this is probably the marketer and luxury brand nightmare. We're being forced to take a pause. And that pause is causing us to, for those of us who wish to be introspective, is getting us to look at what do we really need? What are we really lacking that we really need to go out and buy it to make ourselves happy? I think we're learning to make ourselves happy with other things other than things we acquire through purchases. And, we're finding greater joy in time with family. We're finding a greater joy in making that extra effort to connect via Zoom or Skype or whatever system you use to connect with people who matter to us. We really learn who matters to us by the people that we take the effort to try to connect with, as opposed to people who will just naturally, well, we're going to see them at that event or this place or that place. The people we're learning who really matters to us by the people we keep in touch with. We take that extra step to say, we want to talk to you and set up a camera and, go with it. There's a lot of sober thinking that could be going on and I think is going on. I'm always hesitant to think that it's the majority of people, just again, because I've studied human nature. It is.
And, and part of being a small liberal is you got to believe it is, otherwise, you'd be a conservative. it's one of those little legal fictions. It's you convince yourself that it's got to be true, otherwise the opposite would be just too depressing. But, I want to think that people are thinking about these things, that they are appreciating families, not every single hour of every single day, because, after all, they are families. But, you start to realize what's important in life, and it is human contact and, the joy of doing some things for yourselves and time to do some stuff. And your good health, let's not forget your good health is important. And, everything else is nice. I mean, everyone likes to have, nice stuff, but, it's not the be all and end all.
No. And I think that'll be our end all for this week. We've covered a lot of topics and I'm certain, as we said last week, I'm sure there'll be more to talk about next week. And we were right. I think I wouldn't bet against us having more to talk about next week as this continues to unfold and our lives continue to be impacted by staying indoors and so on. Hopefully next week I'll find some more examples of business ingenuity or civic ingenuity that is helping to adapt to the way we live now so that we can actually feel like we're living now. We can go out and have the circles that tell us what the social distance is or go to the bumper restaurant, with the bumper table.
I want to go to that bumper restaurant. Even when all this is over, I still want to go to the bumper restaurant.
Yeah, me too. Tons of fun. I think that we've covered a fair bit here. So those of you out there, this is our first video version of Stephen and Stephen. Thank you for joining us. So now that you're acclimated to what we actually look like, you won't be shocked next week. And of course, the audio version is going to continue to be available. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Thank you for thinking about what we've had to say. And I also, on behalf of Stephen, thank you for telling other people about this podcast, because word of mouth is the most powerful advertiser because they trust the person that's telling them. So please spread around that this program exists, that the FU Network exists, FU Politics exists. And if you feel so inclined to help us keep going with what we've been doing for the past 6-7 months now, then please go to Patreon and become a patron at patreon.com/FU Network TV. It starts at $1 a month. And if you want to just give a one-time donation, that is much appreciated. You can give us that boost by going to PayPal and sending it to our email address, which is funetworktv@gmail.com. All right, Stephen, thank you very much. Again, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Well, stay well, and we'll do this again next week.
We will indeed. Okay, best to your family and best to all of you out there. I'm Stephen Kersner for Stephen Lawtons. He is on Twitter at Stephen Lawtons. It's STEPHLAUTENS. I'm at Stephen with a V, JKERZNER, at Stephen J. Kersner. And we have a Facebook page as well. We're always looking for feedback. And, you know, if you provide something for us that we're going to talk about, we'll give you credit on the program. So keep that in mind. And have yourselves a good, safe, healthy week. And don't become a COVID idiot and don't get near any of them.
This is fun! The FU Network!